Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. March 6, 2011, BK Corner, episode number 14, The Package Deal. Ding, 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 ring the bell. It's time for another episode of the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. My name is Kevin England, and I'd like to welcome you back to the Beekeeper's Corner. The weather is showing promise, and the crocuses are up in the yard. Those are small little purple flowers if you're not inclined. And that means that fresh beekeeping smell is in the air. I've had a few occasions to meet with fellow beekeepers in the past few weeks, and if instinct has anything to do with it, it seems that beekeeping losses this year are a little better than last year. I'm hearing more and more people say that their bees overwintered well. Other than one report so far of a club member that lost all of their hives, people are saying that if they lost some, it's one or two, not most or all. Time will tell whether the percentages are down, and I have my theories about how the weather was more favorable than last year, but let's save that for some other day. We have an episode to get to. So what's on tap for this go-round? A lot of people have new bees on their minds. Nukes and packages are two popular ways to start hives, and I plan to bring you a primer to help those who are going the package route. Time and time again, I've heard commentary that sublethal pesticide effects are killing bees. And I subscribe to this common sense notion, so I ask, where is the scientific evidence? A new journal with those exact findings was released in late February, and I've got it for you. It's 11:30 at night, and I'm tired, but I'm here plugging away. That gets me to thinking, Kevin Moment here, do bees sleep? Yep. We'll share some insight on that. First, let me shut down the Usher that I have cranking from my Zune player and fire up the mic. It's local hive report time. There's really not that much to report here. You know what? The bees look good. I get into this quandary about whether they have enough stores, but I'm seeing them outside the hive today flying, and you know, the weather's been rather strange here in New Jersey. It's a warm period followed by a cold period. It's 18 degrees at night, and then the next thing you know, it's 50, 55. As I sit here and record this looking outside, it's due to rain tonight, but it's 51 degrees, and here we are in the beginning of March in the evening. So go figure. But the bees were out today flying and sat there and watched for about 20 minutes after getting back from a beekeeper's meeting. And they were bringing in a lot of pollen, so they're finding it. And as I said before, the crocuses are up in the yard. Typically, what we'd find here is we have this substance that grows in our grass, if I can call it grass. I live in the woods, so I don't have a yard like green, immaculate yard like everybody kind of thinks. And we have these things that grow called onion grass, or that's what we refer to them as. They're apparently a delicacy, and they only grow in certain areas, New Jersey, Michigan, and so on. But as soon as those things start to break through the ground, and the crocuses are right behind them, and you can see the daffodils pushing in, that's typically when we start to see our bees out trying to find some pollen. And they're getting it today. They're bringing it in. So both hives were going this afternoon when I got back, and everything looks good. I poured some sugar on the hive, just plain white granulated sugar in case they needed it. And I meant to check that today and didn't get a chance. So maybe if it's not pouring tomorrow, I'll get out there and take a look and see if they have any of it left. But, you know, local hive reports right now, relatively short and sweet. They're doing well. And we're going to make sure that we get them to that nectar flow. So that's it. I said I was going to keep it short and sweet, and that's it for the local hive report this week. We'll see what the next episode brings us as warmer weather is right on the way. Local hive report done. Check. Let's go to segment number one. Our featured segment this week focuses on the purchase of packaged bees. And let me set this segment up and not scare you away, but offer a disclaimer. Someone once told me something during a performance review that has stuck with me, and to some extent defined me. They wrote that I have a desire to be helpful. In this case, I want to talk to you about Package B advice. Am I an expert? No. Am I so experienced at this that I can cite a chapter and verse? No. Do I know more than someone who has never done this before and is trying to Google or Bing the answers for a topic that they don't even have the vernacular to even ask the right questions? Yes. So this is my caveat. I've installed Package Bs, but not in my hives. We started all of our hives with nukes. It is what we started with when we first started our hive, and it's what we've done ever since. I'm a self-professed novice, but if you listen to this podcast, then I hope that you believe I've done my homework and wouldn't lead you astray. All that aside, much of what I tell you is commonly found advice formatted in one place or another, and I am trying to bring it together in one presentation so that you have a good foundation. Beekeeping is not that complicated in some respects, or said another way, you can make it as complicated as you want, but maybe, just maybe, a package is a package is a package, so let's not complicate things. My desire is to arm you with the right information and common sense to get you off to a good start if you're going the package route. So, this is geared for the novices out there. Seasoned beekeepers, you're welcome to listen along too, kind of like a refresher. I'm not adverse to being graded either. If I say something wrong, please correct me. I'll make a correction or share a differing opinion on the next episode if it's warranted. Really, what motivates me is that I'm not of the opinion that our Beekeepers Association get the word out about this topic in a timely manner. I'd like to see Beekeepers Association start their first meetings in time to allow for this topic. Maybe that's not pragmatic, but ordering packages is typically not strategic by the time the first spring meeting rolls around for most clubs. All right. 10 tips for purchasing Package Bs. Number one, I guess the first place you have to start is at the beginning. Decide what kind of bees you want. You know, a simple resource is Wikipedia. It has Italian honeybee, Carnolian, Russian honeybee, and others in the information, and it lists their characteristics and behaviors with the breakdowns of what is beneficial and not so beneficial of these bees, their traits, so to speak. You ask people what they think about certain kind of bees, whether it's an Italian or Russian or whatever, and they'll give you 10 different answers. It seems to be the most consistent place that I've found to just get a basic description of what kind of bees are out there and whether they're good, bad, or indifferent, right? But know this, bees are like children, and no two hives are alike. Labels aside, all the bees will have their minds of their own. So you could buy two exact packages from one supplier, and they'll act differently. But, you know, it's a good idea to know what kind of bees you want and get some advice on that if you're not sure. But always fun to figure out a fundamental. Number two, buy from a reputable dealer. Okay, let's get past one hurdle first. If you're new at this, then how can you tell if a supplier is reputable? You know, one could write a book on this and even may find that the website for the supplier looks great, all the words are there, but in practice the apiary is not up to snuff and the bees don't do well. Was the vendor reputable? Did you do something wrong when the bees died? You might be a new beekeeper after all, so maybe it is your fault. You know, this is the type of thing where reputable becomes a problem because the new beekeeper sometimes can't tell where the issue is. I'll go back to the standard answer for answering this uncertainty. Seek a mentor. Ask at a local association. You are a member, right? Seek a local vendor. Phone a friend. You get the gist. Go find someone you trust and follow their guidance. I said I was going to give tips, so I don't think I'm going to shy away from answering the question, reputable, what does it mean? The beekeepers that sell bees must have strong hives, and they must have productive queens. If a queen is to lay a lot of eggs across a long period of time, they have to have access to a lot of diverse drones. if someone who's a supplier has a limited supply of drones for thousands of hives they're mating, then you're not going to get well-mated bees. You'll get partway through the season and the queen will start laying drones or just stop productivity, and that's just not going to work. So, strong hives, productive queens. Early queens are often cited as weak queens. Early for New Jersey, I'm going to take a swag and say it means March or April. So early queens, they just don't work well. Perhaps they're forced to mate too early in the season. It was too cold. There weren't enough drones at that time because they have to make drones in order to do mating and things like that. Maybe they're stressed colonies from a producer trying to get them out the door. You know, breeders should ensure that queens have well-established brood patterns before they ship them out. And well-seasoned suppliers typically don't fight to be the first to sell their queens. They are the first to take orders and ship them to you when they're ready. Oh, and they do it on a first-come, first-serve basis, and once they reach their quota, they're done. So if you have somebody who will promise you bees till the end of time, be careful what you're asking for. That's a snapshot of what reputable means. Number three, consider pickup versus shipping. So some dealers go south for the winter, little snowbird action, and then they bring those packages back. This is a beekeeper transporting bees versus being shipped by a carrier. There's a lot of pros and cons to that. There's nothing really wrong with somebody shipping you bees, although we'll touch upon that in a couple items from now. But if it's a beekeeper bringing it back, then you know at least they should have followed the right. You know, they're going down to get bees and bring them back to sell them. That's their livelihood. They're going to take care of them. So number four, try to get your order in early. Good suppliers will run out of stock quickly, but don't panic. Most times you can work something out to get quality bees if you ask in the right places. And again, mentor, state associations, local reputable breeders. There are many avenues to go. Best thing is take your action as soon as you know that you want to get bees. Number five, determine when you want them to arrive. They need time to adjust to the new hive and should be up and running when the nectar flow gets into full swing for your area. Now, I want you to recall from our previous episode that bees being packaged are already through some of their lifespan. This means that the package will need to make bees to replenish, and you want to get them in time to pull the nectar in for a strong hive. Remember, it takes about 40 days to make a forager. And also remember that if they have to build wax, that takes time in feeding too. More on that in a bit. Number six, inspect upon arrival, and if they're not right, contact your dealer. So get them when you get them and inspect them right away. Have the shipping person hold on, and if the shipping person is standing there after you do your inspection, ask them to take a note of what the condition is before they leave. Experienced beekeepers offer that no matter the condition of the package, and this is, your mileage may vary, accept the package with it, with whatever the conditions are, and deal with it afterwards. So I'll just ask this common sense question. What's the post office going to do if you refuse this package? You know, it's your choice, but there's stories about how the post office on the web doesn't like to deal with these things, these critters in a box, so to speak. And this is just one more headache for them. So for the beekeeping industry at large, it's probably better if you keep them. Incidentally, if you do keep them and you make a note to the shipper, you can then take those bees and figure out what happened to them. And if you're so inclined, send them for analysis to see how healthy they were before you go back to that same vendor. Could prove interesting. Number seven, choose a proper size for what you want to have happen. It's recommended that you start with a package that is at least 3 pounds. That's going to give you X number of bees. They make packages in all sizes, smaller, larger, and so on. Not that all small packages will make honey for you right away, right? So understand that 3 pounds of bees not going to make your honey right away. It takes far more bees to make honey than 3 pounds. And when you order smaller packages, they take longer to build to overwinter numbers, meaning enough bees that they'll be able to support the warmth to overwinter in the Northeast region. I'm speaking for New Jersey folks. If you have a short nectar season, you may also want to start with more bees. No matter what the size of the package, again, feed the bees so they build out wax and stimulate brood production. I'm going to cover this more in segment number 2 about packages. Number 8, buyer beware. Ask about potential problem resolutions before they happen, not after you have a box of damaged bees. As a buyer of bees, and when purchasing for the first time from a vendor, don't be shy about getting the details on what you're purchasing. Now, don't be a nudge, but you're entitled to ask questions, and a reputable supplier should have the right answers for you. You know, hopefully their website is up to date and provides the information, but a lot of beekeepers are not so web savvy, so you'll have to ask them. And again, going back to our previous tip, recommendations from the club members are even better, as novices are often intimidated by the subject and just don't do well at finding the right questions when dealing with someone on the phone. Somebody that raises bees for a living and is far better versed to answer any questions that you might throw at them. So here's a suggestion from you. Go in with the club. Go in with seasoned beekeepers that are buying their bees and let them help you. And they'll ask the right questions on your behalf, and you'll have more leverage if something goes wrong when you're a pool of people buying from a supplier. And if you establish some sort of supplier relationship, then that's all the better in your beekeeping career. Let's go to number 9, consider the shipping laws. So many states require certificates. It is, in fact, a reasonable idea to ask a producer to provide paperwork on the bees you're purchasing, and you should know if your state requires it. Let's go to Virginia for an example. They will fine you if you bring your bees in and don't have the state certificate with it. So these beekeeper suppliers know that wherever they're shipping, some places require certificates and you should ask for it. On the other aspect of this, there could be a certificate of health from the vendor's state apiary inspector. And if they don't provide one, if the vendor refuses, you should be wary about that. In New Jersey, there is a certified list of vendors on the website, in the State of New Jersey website, and we'll provide a link to that in the show notes, which I'll tell you how to find in a bit. And you should talk to also the state apiarist if you're concerned about where you're getting your bees from. And let's go to number 10, which is just a nicety don't forget. New beekeepers, you might consider asking for marked queens. So if the queen comes and she's got a painted dot on her, that gives you a couple things. It makes her easier to find, which is a challenging task sometimes and daunting for new beekeepers. And it also gives you a dot that indicates what year the bee was born, or hatched, or delivered, or you know what I mean. There, and if you don't, actually, maybe I shouldn't say that. Queens are marked with a different color every year. If you watch our video on our website about how queen marking occurs, they'll explain the mnemonic that tells you what color is for what year. I don't seem to recall it right now. I always have to look it up, but it's just a good idea. Number 10 tip is to get your queen marked if you could do it. Now, sometimes the bees come in and they clean the queen off or rubs off or whatever the case may be, but still. And okay, so we got to 10. Let's give you some crumbs, some last minute tips in preparing for the arrivals. Have your hives ready when the packages are going to arrive. You want to leave your bees sitting out in the sun or sitting alongside the garage while you're trying to get your woodenware done. And that means paint your hives and have them ready and assembled and let them dry out. So even if you're using latex paint or something that shouldn't necessarily bother the bees and be a problem from an environmental standpoint, paint dries. And when paint dries, it gives off fumes and odors. And you really want those hives ready to go when the bees come in. Don't leave your bees in the sun. They do better in a cool area than a hot area. If you leave them in the sun for just even a short while, they could potentially die. And last but not least, install them as soon as you can. But if it's going to be a while, make sure they're not out of food. They should come with a canister of food. And a lot of people will recommend that you try and install them that day, that evening. If it's not raining, if it's not super windy or whatever, get them in the box, get them settled in. And one final tip, near and dear to the state apiarist, register your hives. Even if you're adding new ones, they'll want to know how many you have, and go fill out the form. Make sure your apiarist, I can't even say that word. I wish they called it apiarian. When I listened to the Langstroth on the hive and the honeybee, they referred to a beekeeper as an apiarian, and that's an easier word to say, but bottom line, go register your hives. So we're going to take a short break right now. We'll come back with the rest of Package Bees. We're going to talk about what to expect from Package Bees the first 2 years. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Beekeeper's Corner podcast. Before I dive in here, let me take a moment to tell you where you can find the show notes for the show. You can access them at our website, www.bkcorner.org. You can also send me an email if you have some commentary about my first segment, or some corrections, or some additional tips that others might want to hear. It's kevin@bkcorner.org. So what to expect from Package Bees the first 2 years. For this feature, I'm going to reference some sage information from one of my favorite sources and something that I've referenced in the past. George Emery's notes from the Pink Pages collection. George wrote a pink page on the Package Bee colony performance in the first year, and it's actually what inspired me to bring this topic to the podcast. I'm going to take some time to walk you through a first-year expectation and baseline you on what your objectives should be and lead you into how you're going to get there. We'll start with some insight on how many bees you'll start with and how to progress them. We'll let you know what the prospects are for honey, which, if you're a new beekeeper, is probably a payoff you're looking for. And we'll take you through an abbreviated bee year so you can start with the end in mind. And by the end, I'm going to say overwintering and a strong colony to start the next season with, and lots of options. First, some fundamentals. Bees require food to make wax. In fact, bees, according to George's notes, need about 8 pounds of honey or an equivalent 40 pounds of nectar to make 1 pound of wax. Either one of two things need to happen right away. The bees you package need to forage, or you need to feed the bees. Keep this quick factoid close at hand as we proceed. Oh, and by the way, the bees need nectar and pollen for raising brood too. Number of bees. So let's talk numbers. When starting a package hive, the typical order is about a 3 pound package. 3 pounds of bees equates to around 10,000 bees. A high production colony, one that makes lots of honey, folks, will be 50 to 60,000 bees. Simple math tells us that we need to build bees. And really what we're looking for in the big picture is to have a hive that survives and prospers. We want a hive that can defend, bring in pollen, make and store honey, obtain and deposit propolis, and to sustain itself and ultimately overwinter. Notice I didn't say make us honey. It is possible to get honey, but let's keep that in check for a moment. The bees that your supplier pulled out of one of their mating hives and shipped to you are teenagers to old ladies, so to speak. Getting to one of those George Emery comments, quote, it is possible that half your package bees could be dead before the first new worker bee emerges from its cell, end quote. Making bees is important, but we have a chicken and egg situation if you have a brand new box. Queens lay eggs in comb, not on blank foundation. Therefore, the thing we want to have happen is to have the bees build wax comb. Here's the catch. Bees can't build wax without food. Let's check what George has to say about this. Package bees must secrete wax to build comb on foundation for the queen to lay in and comb to store pollen and nectar. Bees must consume about 8 pounds of honey, about 40 pounds of nectar, to make and construct 1 pound of wax comb. End quote. So here's the bottom line. You dump your package in your new hive, on your spanking new foundation, and you'll feed them, and feed them, and feed them, so they can build bees and get off to a good start and head to the overall objective of overwintering. All right, switching gears. Timing is everything. So we know one of our goals is a full box of bees with the real objective of being able to overwinter. There are some pitfalls to consider, and timing is everything, as they say. The time frame of when you receive your package plays a big part in how you proceed. Difficulty number one. Sometimes bees don't come at the optimal time. Why don't bees always come at the optimal time? Ideally, you want your package to arrive when it's warm enough for them to operate and the nectar is beginning to flow. The opposite, and unfortunately how it goes sometimes, is that you get your bees late and they ramp up on the tail end of the nectar flow. Sometimes, no matter how well-intentioned, suppliers just can't get bees out in the ideal time frames for you to start a colony. Wet spring, lingering cold weather. The suppliers are often at the mercy of Mother Nature and a high demand for bees. Many packages sold to beekeepers in New Jersey come from the South or even California because their spring breaks earlier than ours. Living in the South or even California doesn't mean a guarantee of the ideal queen rearing conditions. Reputable beekeepers will sell you good stock, and they just can't manufacture bees for everyone on a preordained schedule. It doesn't work that way. So this is why you may see suppliers indicate that they are at their quota and don't have any more packages to offer. This means that sometimes you get your bees late or not at all. Difficulty number two. You had no idea that you were supposed to order your bees in December while standing there at your first beekeeper's meeting in late May or March or April. Most newbies, pun intended, join the ranks of beekeepers after the hibernation breaks. What I mean by that is most clubs kick off their activities and awareness to new beekeepers when the weather warms up. The seasoned beekeepers have already ordered their stuff in December. The new beekeepers come late into the game and get the scraps, so to speak, the second round leftovers. Fortunately, there's a workaround for this, and as there typically is someone who knows someone who can get you some bees. If you want bees, there's always almost a way, but that brings us to difficulty number three. Late starts put overwintering prospects at risk. So they get a late start. What's the big deal? It's a big world out there. When starting bees, you want them to ramp up at the optimal time so they have the best facilities to gather nectar, pollen, water, propolis, and build wax. Nectar and pollen are essential to feed and grow new bees. And in nature, the spring flow stimulates the queen to lay eggs. Propolis is used to seal the hive for temperature control, and it's also used for the bees to build immunity in the hive. If you get your bees late, nectar flows dwindle, summer dryness causes stress on bees when things dry up and they can't find water, and it becomes difficult for them to get the numbers they need to be a productive colony. Alright, let me not be all doom and gloom. If you get your bees prior to the nectar flow, feed them. Give them a 1-to-1 sugar to water solution and keep feeding them until the nectar flows. They will use that solution, or as George calls it, artificial nectar, to make wax and make bees. You can continue to feed them through the nectar flow, but chances are when they have the opportunity to get pollen and nectar from nature, they will stop taking it. In this scenario, it is possible on a good year to actually get some honey on a super in a box, but in a good year. Now, one can't be greedy, as the rule of thumb is that you want to give them at least 10 frames to overwinter. But if they make more than 10 frames, then maybe you could sneak some the first year. Let's not get distracted from our mission, though, overwinter. When nectar dries up and the creeks dry up from the summer, there are still bees to make. The hive should be populated by now, but these aren't the bees that you'll overwinter with. Time to build winter bees. Fall feeding switches to a 2-to-1 solution, as you don't want to get too much moisture in the hive. And too much moisture late in the season can be difficult for the bees to handle over winter and lead to dysentery, either in the winter or the following spring. And you also have to consider pollen patties are needed to feed the workforce and the brood because they need pollen in order to make young. That's the protein. So you want to be careful also that you mind the varroa mites and you manage them and keep them down so they don't damage your winter bee crop. And, you know, maybe you could consider a fall nectar flow to top things off. But wait. I should come clean. Didn't I just lay out the perfect path? You get your bees before and you go through the motions and you do everything, you know? Yeah, I know I did that. But you know what? If the bees come late, you're going to follow the same routine. So there is no nectar flow. You're going to be the nectar flow. You're going to put the honey on the hive or the sugar water on the hive. They still need to be fed. They still need to be managed for varroa. They still need pollen, and the trick here is they need to be fed continuously, and they need at least 10 frames of honey and reasonable stores of pollen and enough bees to overwinter. The optimal situation is that nature provides for the bees, and with some help from you, the diligent beekeeper, you can get them through, and they can become a healthy and productive colony. So if you feed your bees and you mind the varroa and do all those things that I just said, you'll overwinter, and then spring will break. And that's kind of the pattern we're following right now in our home hives. Started them up last year, took care of them, they overwintered, and now we're hoping to ramp them up for a honey crop, and you should do the same. And then in year two, you're going to follow the progress of the queens and make sure that, well, we have two hives, so I say queens, but follow the progress of each queen that you have, that they have good laying patterns through. Some people will tell you to cull the queen in the fall and start with a fresh, vigorous queen going into the fall, so your next following year will be great. To each his own on the advice there, but, you know, bottom line is, if you can get that package up and running, get the right amount of bees, get all that stuff in, they should come out of the gate good the following year to produce honey. And all things aside, I've talked about packages. We started with a nuke on our first year. And the nuke had more bees than a package. And it had a pretty established colony with a pretty hard-working queen. And we had a good year in our first year. It was 2008. And that hive ramped up and actually gave us a box full of honey, and they overwintered just fabulously. So if all is said and done, and you're trying to decide what to do, maybe the last segment of advice is maybe you could start with a nuke. And for those who don't know what a nuke is, it's a box of bees on a certain number of frames. It's like a half a hive that you transfer and put in your hive, and you start with something established versus a brand new hive with bees on foundation. So maybe that's the last sage advice. Is mind you, a nuke is more expensive, and there is something satisfying, folks, about starting with a package of bees. So I think I've plumb worn this topic out. Again, if you're listening to this and you have some advice that you'd like to share with the listeners, and take issue with anything that I've said, I'd be happy to hear from you. I'd be happy to put that out. I'm never shy about being corrected, and enjoy the feedback that I get from the listeners. Kevin at BK Corner, if you have any topics. All right, once again, time to switch gears here. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with the study, sub-lethal effects of pesticide residues in brood comb on worker honeybee development and longevity. This is worth the wait, folks. We'll be right back. It seems to me that if you ask some people in the know about what is colony collapse disorder, they're going to tell you there's no magic bullet. And I've listened to different interviews with different researchers, journalists, and so on, and while the media likes this colony collapse disorder descriptions as a neat and tidy package for the plight of the bees, the common consensus that I hear a lot of times, and that I do believe in based on what I've learned, is that sublethal effects are really what's going on. There's several stresses, whether it's from the commercial industries and what they do, the chemicals in the hive, the chemicals or pesticides that they're applying in nature, the varroa. It's just too much. And I've been waiting for the study and the science that comes out, and time again we've heard that pesticides are killing the bees. I've said this on the podcast that I wasn't going to jump on the bandwagon and wanted to let the topic mature before I drew conclusions. I read on a forum someone's opinion about this same topic, and they put it in a way I only wish I could have come up with. The way they eloquently stated this position is, I do my best to avoid agendas and concentrate on the data and results. Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here and share that I found what I think is the first linkage to many of the problems that have been covered for sublethal aspects in an article published on the journal Plus One. And if you're looking for Plus One, it's PLOSONE, titled Sublethal Effects of Pesticide Residue in Brood Comb on Worker Honeybee, in parentheses Apis mellifera, Development and Longevity. This result brings to light the impact that pesticides are having on bees in a way that I've been expecting. Let me introduce the study and point you to the actual article so you can read and interpret it for yourself. The study, which took place between May and August of 2008 and 2009, was conducted by the Washington State University Department of Entomology. In the study, they used comb contaminated with pesticides and put it in a hive with non-pesticide control wax. The findings of the study concluded things that you would expect, that pesticides impact bees, that it gets into the uncontaminated comb, but there is so much more to the result. We all know that bees hatch out in a defined timeline. The typical number often cited is 21 days. They found that there was a shift in bee emergence during subsequent replications when pesticides were present in the hive. Another way to say this is that the typical emergence is on days 20, 21, and 22, with more bees coming earlier in that time frame than later. Add pesticides to the mix, and the emergences move to the right with the bees coming out later. In the study with the control comb, this is the uncontaminated wax, 5% of the bees exited on day 22. With pesticide, the third replicate, or cycle if you don't like that word, the percentage of bees exiting on day 22 went up to 18%. Let's take a side journey and share why this is important. What happens when varroa is added to the mix of the developing bee? The longer emergence takes, the more varroa can reach mature state and the more fecundity can take place. Fecundity is the term. It means laying eggs. If the worker bees are emerging later and there are varroa involved, varroa win. Let's just make it as simple as that. So let's move on to another aspect of the findings. The conclusion of the study is that worker bees are living 4 days less when exposed to the pesticides versus when compared to the control comb. The study suggests that, quote, over the long term, this activity could affect an entire cascade of hive activities, including brood care, food processing and storage, queen care, hygienic behavior, and foraging efficiency, disrupting age-based polyethism and its role in colony homeostasis, end quote. In short, this particular finding could mean that the entire ecosystem of the hive can become off balance. But wait, there's more. The study concluded that total larval mortality increased with the repeated use of experimental frames and control combs from, get this, 13% through the first brood cycle, meaning the first time they ran it through, to 28% in the second and 39% in the third. So the bees are generating life cycles and they're bringing pesticide from the outside, and there's the pesticide transferring from the pesticide samples inside the comb, and the pesticides are building up and they are having larval mortality, larvae, probably a better way to say this, and it's going from 13% to 28% to 39%. In this study, they also noted delayed development of larvae on combs with high levels of pesticide residues from the colony suspected to have CCD, where they got the comb from. So the pictures and the diagrams that accompany the study are compelling, and you should check those out. In this instance, I'm going to stop right here. I'm going to stop and suggest that you as a beekeeper go read this journal entry directly. I'm going to warn you, it's not easy to read, but if you scan it, you can get the flavor of what I've been sharing over these last few minutes. You know, time and time again, those who have been talking about discovering the cause of CCD refer to sublethal effects of either pesticides or chemicals in the hive. And when I said chemicals earlier, I mean the chemicals that we're putting in the hive, Cumafos, Fluvinate, and those things that we were trying to kill mites with. My episode last week commented about Jennifer Berry's, we're taking insecticides and putting them in a box of insects. So, bottom line, this is one of the most compelling pieces that I've found to back up the claims that sublethal is really impacting, and they are showing tangible pieces where the hives are being impacted. So, okay, Kevin moment. I research and read these journal entries, among many journals, Beyond, Plus One, and others, mostly because they cover interesting topics of bee science, or more specifically, why and how bee things occur, and why bees do what they do, and the biology of the bees, because, as you could probably tell, that interests me. Every once in a while, though, you find an article like this one, which is a different thing altogether. So here's my problem. It's in a journal that has to stand for something. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a college professor or someone who works in university studies. So I'll say this. Will someone come out in the coming days and debunk this thing? I have no idea how it works. This journal article was received May 4th, 2010 by Plus One. It was accepted January 20th, 2011. It was published only recently on February 23rd, 2011. When I pulled it from the web, it had only been accessed 335 times. So time will only tell whether this will be accepted by those in the know, or if perhaps the way they conducted the study will discount its validity someday. I just don't have the chops to know, but I'll tell you one thing. This is the first study that answers some interesting questions and shows tangible impacts of pesticides and chemicals in the hive. And I'll tell you, I'll be replacing my comb regularly. Thank you very much. Okay, one more segment to go. When we come back, a brief blurb on another one of life's greatest questions. For beekeepers, that is. What exactly does happen when a bee sleeps? Stay with us, won't you? Having a pretty tough day at work the other day, I went and grabbed my lunch and brought it back to my office, and while I was sitting there taking a break, I went and surfed the web and looked for a couple beekeeping articles just to occupy myself. One that came in particular, that interested me was a lecture from 2010 that had three topics from Barrett Anthony Klein for the Center of Contemporary Studies, Indian Institute of the Science of Bangalore. I'll say that 25 times. The lecture had a component of it about how bees sleep. And I checked in on the summary of what was covered in the lecture and decided to dig a little bit deeper. The presenter, as it turns out, published a paper in which they reviewed caste-dependent sleep of worker honeybees. You know, the word caste never resonated with me. I always think I want to pronounce it caste. And I want to deviate for a second and go to term of the day, or maybe better said, term of the episode, based on fact that we don't produce one of these every day. The term caste, C-A-S-T-E, ties back to class and rank or position of somebody in society according to birth, occupation, or some other criterion. India, as an example, has a well-known caste system where people marry within the same caste of people. Higher castes often hold more power, and typically one does not transfer from one caste to another. In the caste of honeybees, we know the opposite is true. Bees traverse through roles as they mature and age in such capacities such as cell cleaners, nurse bees, food storers, and foragers. So it turns out caste has quite an impact on how honeybees sleep. Apis mellifera, or our European honeybees that we have in the U.S., exhibit polytheism. Polytheism means that the bees change tasks they perform with age. The general rule of things goes something like this. A newly emerged bee, referred to as a callow, spends its first days oriented head down cleaning cells. After about 3 days, they graduate to nurse bees from days 4 through 12 of their life. Then they are off as a food storer, and they perform that duty from days 13 to 20. Once completed as a food storer, they enter into the final stage and will spend the remainder of their days as a forager. Now, this is a general guideline, and the days as a role are flexible and dependent upon the needs of the colony. Tying this back to sleep, the tasks performed by the bees profoundly influence the way the bees sleep. Here's a question for the study. How does one tell if a bee is sleeping? The study described it this way. Worker honeybees appear to be sleeping when relatively immobile, with body and appendages slumping in the direction of gravity. Relative immobility refers here to bees that are immobile except for exhibiting occasional, apparently spontaneous antennal, tarsal, or leg twitches, or proboscis extensions, or discontinuous respiratory pumping motions of the gaster. That's sometimes you see the abdomen of the bee come in and out, kind of like an accordion, so to speak, and they use other terms here. Going on with their description, this postural state can be sustained for extended periods, but is easily reversed, often by the physical contact of a neighboring bee. In studying the bees, it was observed that the circadian rhythms of the bees changed with caste. Foragers out all day and in at night showed diurnal rhythms, meaning they rest at night. In contrast to that, nurse bees do not show a 24-hour cycle of rest and work activities. To perform the studies, the researchers marked bees of varying castes and recorded the sleep patterns of the bees and where they slept within the confines of the hives. They used a combination of light and red light and other measures to ensure that they could follow the bees from their markings, and they marked the bees on the abdomen and on the back end of the bee so that if they were head down, they could tell where the bee was in the cell. Bees sometimes sleep in a cell, and sometimes they go to the outer perimeter of the hive. In fact, the findings indicated that the bees slept in different postures, sometimes hanging, sometimes in isolated areas, sometimes leaning against the hive wall or floor, and even sleeping in groups, kind of like a bee pajama party, if you will. Older bees slept longer than younger bees, and with greater consistency over a 24-hour window. The sleep patterns, judged in this case by antenna movement, did not differ between the cell cleaners and the nurse bees, but was greater in food storers and more pronounced in foragers. Sleep outside of the cells did not significantly differ between night and day for the cell cleaners or for the nurse bees, but food storers and foragers spent more time sleeping outside of the cells during the night than during the day. Cell cleaners and nurse bees were as immobile in sleep during the day as they were at night. This is likely attributed to the job for them that works around the clock. One other observation of the study is that as the younger bees age, they experience longer, unbroken bouts of sleep outside the cells. So there you have it, a little insight on how bees sleep and how it works, and maybe, just maybe, you'll be able to crack open a hive and peek in there and find them taking a siesta. Okay, what's not going to be funny is if I don't get to sleep, I'm going to fall asleep on you right here. So I think it's time to wrap this episode up. But before we go, let me make a nod to the Southern Maryland Beekeeper Podcast. The podcaster, I hope I pronounce his name right, Greg Yerden, listens to us, and we do the same, listen to his. He has some great interviews over there right now of the Fat Bee Man in a three-part series. Some really fascinating stuff. But he tipped me off to the fact that I was recording in mono on the left side channel, not the right side channel. What that means is if you were listening in your iPod, you were painfully aware that you were only getting it through one earbud, and I was blissfully unaware that this was going on. So different recording mechanism this time by. I'm reporting in stereo, on a headset, switched out the microphone and trying a different piece here. So we'll see how it sounds, and hopefully this will improve the experience for you if you've been suffering. Sorry about that. I had no idea the software that I used to record was set up so that it just recorded one channel. I didn't have it open to be able to see both, and didn't even realize I wasn't doing in stereo. So now you have me live at 5, ground pounding stereo, and hopefully I sound okay with this new microphone setup that I have. So enough on that. Thanks for listening here at the Beekeeper's Corner. We'll see what we can find out to bring you for the next episode. Got a lot of busy stuff coming up here for work, and Boy Scouts and a couple other things, so may have to take a short hiatus here for a little bit, but so many things going on in the beekeeping world. This is the time when we want to get ramped up, so you can bet that as soon as I get a free moment, we'll be back behind the microphone. So that's going to wrap it up for this episode, episode number 14. Again, any comments you want to send our way, it's kevin@bkcorner.org, or you could reach us at our website, www.bkcorner.org. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next time on the Beekeeper's Corner podcast.
Golden hair running from a wind, like the weed out on the plain. Distant eyes shining of the moon, pulled towards madness like a chain. So far, far away, long to knit searching fingers. I swear, and I feel as though I'm grasping at the air. Is this madness? Is this oblivion? A poetry of wonder? Is this madness? Is this oblivion, a poetry, a wonder? Pounding hearts running through the night, wish a touch, a murmur, a kiss, whispering legs wrapped all around me, moving both of us to bliss. Voices light the spark, becoming more than whole. Is this madness? Is this oblivion? A poetry, a wonder? Is this madness? Is this oblivion? A poetry, a wonder? Madness, is this oblivion, a poetry? enough? Is this madness? Is this oblivion?